Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and as President Obama fights for his new national security team, Hagel, Kerry, and Brennan, and by the way, just out in the last few minutes, he's going to nominate Jack Lew, the current chief of staff, as Treasury Secretary to replace Tim Geithner. But as the president fights for his new national security team, our first guest this hour is one of the nation's top military reporters with a new book about the outgoing CIA director, General David Petraeus. The book describes how Petraeus revolutionized the U.S. military, but how his famous troop surges in Afghanistan and Iraq were not as successful as often portrayed. We will even learn how Petraeus reportedly lied to President Obama to win approval for the Afghanistan surge. And we'll get Fred's take on the president's controversial new nominees. The book is called The Insurgents, David Petraeus and the Plot to Change the American Way of War. Hi, Fred Kaplan. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks a lot.
The Plot to Change the American Way of War. It sounds like a true crime story.
Well, it's a true story, and it depends how you define crimes, but it was a plot. And, you know, I'm really not very keen on conspiracy theories, but these guys saw it as a plot. They called themselves the Cabal or the West Point Mafia. There was an explicit plot, there's no other way to put it, to change the culture and the policies and the definition of war.
From what
from,
to what?
From within inside the military. Well, before Petraeus became commander in Iraq, that is not so long ago, 2005, 2006, the definition of war in Army field manuals, things like that, was major combat operations, tank versus tank on a big battlefield against a major foe. Smaller things against insurgencies, terrorists, things like that. It was called Military Operations Other Than War. Mm. That's with capital letters, MOOTW.
Wow.
They called it MOOTWA. And there was a chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff who famously said, real men don't do MOOTWA. Now, you look at a guy like Petraeus and the generation just behind him, people, you know, up to 10 years younger than he, what were they doing in the 80s and early 90s? They were in El Salvador, Bosnia, Somalia. These were not...
Those were wars.
Yeah, but they weren't called wars by the Army generals. They were not wars. Well, it sure felt like wars to them. And so they resolved that we're going to change this. That they thought, look, this is the kind of wars that we're going to be facing. The Cold War is over at this point. The Soviet Union is dissolving.
And the enemy since 2001 has been Al-Qaeda, which is not a nation
right.
state.
And so... Even before, though, the attack on the World Trade Center, they said, look, this is the kind of enemy we're going to be facing. These are the kind of conflicts that politicians are going to be getting us involved with. We have to change the Army so that we can deal with these kinds of threats.
By the way, a side note, but a really interesting one. You're right that it was no coincidence that Petraeus, as this revolutionary, that his parents were a seaman and a librarian.
Right.
How did that shape him into an innovative war planner?
Well, I think, you know, he had a proverbially crusty Dutch seaman as a father. And the way I put it is that his father taught him that it was important to win and his mother taught him that it was important to read. And he used each of those things to accomplish the other.
And so you tell us that at West Point, as a cadet, he studied old books on counterinsurgency
right.
that had been forgotten as outdated during the Cold War.
That's right.
So was Petraeus' new set of tactics really a retro old set?
It is retro. You know, these things move in cycles. We tend to get involved in these kinds of wars about once every generation, and it's such an unpleasant experience that the Army sets about as quickly as possible to forget and throw out the lessons of those conflicts so that by the time the next one rolls around, nobody remembers the old lessons.
We fight
so
the last
you
war.
Keep making the same mistakes.
We always fight the last war, but not the second to last
that,
war.
Exactly. We fight the war that is most appetizing, the one that conforms most strongly and closely to our own preconceptions of what war is.
Fred Kaplan from Slate, his new book, The Insurgents, David Petraeus and the Plot to Change the American Way of War. We can take your phone calls for him on the Petraeus legacy or on the president's new national security nominees, 212-433 WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show, and we'll get to the current news. But the troop surge in Iraq, the mythology is that that's what turned the war from a losing effort to a winning one. But you write that while the surge was a tactical success, it probably made no strategic difference to the outcome of the war. Well, you don't think?
Well, here's what I mean in that sense. Petraeus himself, when he outlined this new policy, said, look, what we're trying to do is to create some breathing space, a zone of security so that the Iraqi political factions can get their act together without worrying about getting blown up every 5 minutes. And that part of it worked. And it worked more as a result of what Petraeus and his fellow insurgents within the army did than I used to believe before I started researching this book.
Uh-huh.
But where it didn't work is that it turned out that Prime Minister Maliki had no interest in actually reconciling the Sunnis and the Shia. He had promised, oh, yes, we will work out a formula for sharing oil wealth. Never happened. Oh, yes, I will bring in the converted Sunni militants who are now joining with the Americans to fight jihadists. I will bring them into the Iraqi National Army. Never happened.
He just wanted the Shia majority to vanquish the Sunni
yes,
minority?
That's basically what he did. And that is why, although, listen, what Petraeus accomplished, and it wasn't just Petraeus, and it was Petraeus within a certain context in which the policies he wanted to put forth were facilitated. But what he did, it really did lower the level of violence dramatically. But you still see reports of car bombs. You still see the same kind of ethnic sectarian violence going on. And there doesn't seem to be, any recipe for resolution in the near future.
And in terms of how it worked, at least for a while, there's at least one story from your book on the Sunnis that reminded me of the movie Lincoln. Have you seen the film yet?
I have, yes.
So rounding up votes for the 13th Amendment to abolish slavery, Lincoln starts bribing members of Congress
yes.
who are opposed or undecided with a lot of patronage jobs, if they'll vote yes. And you have Petraeus paying Sunni militiamen who have been fighting against the United States to switch sides. Really?
Yes, absolutely. And he did it without getting any authorization for this from Washington. He had a commander's discretionary fund. And in most places, what that was used for is, paying people to sweep up the streets or, join the city council or something. He used it to bribe Sunni militiamen to come on to switch sides. Now, they were predisposed to switching sides. At the time, especially in western Iraq, they were allied with jihadists, al-Qaeda in Iraq, that sort of thing. They were getting disgusted with their jihadist allies who are really behaving beyond the pale. And so they were inclined to switch. And he made it a lot easier. He created this entity called the Sons of Iraq. And there was this big swearing-in ceremony. And, he paid their salaries out of I think if that had been revealed at the time before it became a big success, I think his superiors would have said no way, and that's why he didn't tell them.
I think John in Bergen County wants to talk about this point. Hi, John.
Good morning, Brian. What I don't understand is that everyone keeps crediting the fact of the extra 30,000 troops he sent to Iraq as a surge as being successful. But I think the speaker hit the point which I had heard previously, in that we actually paid people, I think it was the Shiites, to fight against the Sunnis, and that was more successful than it caught 30,000 additional troops. Does he agree with that premise?
No, that's not. I know that Michael Hastings and people like that have said that, and that's not true. At the same time that he was paying the Sunnis to fight against the more extreme jihadists, he was also raiding the Shia militia strong points in Sadr City and Baghdad. That's another interesting story about Petraeus's M.O. His predecessor, General George Casey, he had wanted to raid those Shia strongholds. Maliki, who was allied with Muqtada Sadr, said, no, stay out of Sadr City. And he said, okay, it's your country. Petraeus comes in. He just does it. He does it. And in the meantime, he had got Ambassador Crocker and the political team in Baghdad to understand what he was doing, so that when Maliki went to complain to the ambassador about what Petraeus was doing, Crocker said, hey, you want me to go talk with George Bush about this? I'll do it, and I'll explain everything to him. And by the way, here's some intelligence showing that Sadr isn't the big ally that you think he is. So it was not – this was actually a lot more complex and a lot defter than simply paying one side to kill off the other side. That's really not what happened.
Fred Kaplan from Slate, his new book, The Insurgents, David Petraeus and the Plot to Change the American Way of War. I mentioned at the top your story from the book of Petraeus basically lying to President Obama to get him to approve the troop surge in Afghanistan, saying that with a surge, he could turn that war over to the Afghans in 18 months. When exactly did that happen, and how did that go?
Well, you remember all through the last half of 2009, there were these 10 meetings with Obama and his national security advisors to figure out a new policy toward Iraq, toward Afghanistan. At the last meeting, which was just in the Oval Office, and it was just the generals, his top national security advisors, Secretary of Defense Gates, Obama said, okay, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you 33,000 troops. I'm going to give 7,000 from NATO, and we're going to start pulling them out 18 months from now. Now, can you tell me that with what I'm giving you, you'll be able to turn over, it'll be so improved that the Afghan army will be able to take the lead in a majority of districts in Afghanistan? Because if you don't think that's going to happen, I can just give you 10,000 troops to improve training, and that's all we'll do. And by the way, don't think that if you make a little bit of progress, I'm going to come back in 18 months and give you double the number of troops. And everybody around the table said, yes, sir, can do, can do. Petraeus knew, because everything that he'd studied and observed about counterinsurgency warfare told him that these things take years to settle. He knew that it was not going to take this short a time. His line to his friends who asked him, why did you say yes, was, well, look, it wasn't that kind of meeting. This was a take it or leave it deal. And so I took it. My view is that, you know, he shouldn't have taken it. I mean, it is the responsibility of the commander to speak truth to power. When the president is asking you for your professional military opinion, even if you say, well, I know what the answer is that he wants, you should tell him the answer. But, I mean, I think if some more people had stood up and said, you know, sir, I don't think this is really going to work, Obama might not have gone in so deeply mm-hmm. with such an ambitious strategy, which, by the way, 18 months when it wasn't working, he pulled out the surge forces and he retreated on his strategy, more back to what Biden was emphasizing at the beginning, which was a scaled back approach just to go out after the insurgents, especially al-Qaeda on the border, and not to try to mess around with making the Afghan government a more responsible entity, which it just wasn't capable or willing to do.
You had access to David Petraeus for this book.
Oh, yeah, lots.
Did he acknowledge, in effect, deceiving the president?
Oh, he acknowledged that this happened, and his line was that, well, look, it wasn't that kind of meeting. It wasn't a kind of meeting where he really wanted our advice. And you know, by the way, what I'm saying right here on the microphone, I'm not saying this behind his back. I made this point
to him.
You know, he respectfully disagrees. But I think that the responsibility of a commander is a little higher than playing games with the president's games.
So Obama then appoints Petraeus CIA director rather than chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the job you say Petraeus actually wanted. Was that an act of no confidence in a certain way?
Well, you know, during these deliberations, there was a feeling among many in the White House, not so much Obama, but a lot of his staff that thought the generals were boxing him in. Obama would ask for more options, like, well, what if we put 10,000 or 20,000 troops in? And they wouldn't come up with the answer. And so they didn't quite trust Petraeus. The other thing about the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, it is potentially an extremely powerful job. You have hundreds of the smartest colonels in the military working under you in 9 directorates. The last chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff who really used this thing well was Colin Powell. And he was running circles around the interagency processes in Washington. And anyone who has still been around, one person told me, anybody who remembers what Powell did as chairman would never appoint David Petraeus as chairman because he's too smart. He's too resourceful. He would use that position to become more powerful than anybody would want a general to be.
And by the way, the surge did not work in Afghanistan as well as it did in Iraq.
Well,
did Petraeus fundamentally misunderstand Afghanistan, smart as he is?
Well, it's more than that. He really didn't understand Afghanistan, didn't miss it. He didn't, and he knew this. But look, here's the thing. He comes off this triumph in Iraq. Everybody is expecting him to pull off another miracle in Afghanistan. He only has a year to do it. And so, you know, you draw on what you know. And I, some of his staffers told me that he would, you know, be presented with a problem and he'd say, well, you know, in Anbar we did this, or in Baghdad we did that. Or even in one meeting with Karzai, he says, well, you know, in Mosul we did it this way, you know, to the president of Afghanistan. And his aide, who had worked in Iraq and Afghanistan, both coming out of the meeting, he said, you know, it might be an interesting experiment for you not to think about Iraq at all. And he said, I'm working on it. But he tried to apply the same principles. Here's the thing about counterinsurgency. There's no magic to it. It's like any other kind of field manual or doctrine of war. Okay, there's a manual on tank warfare. If you have a vast open plain and a lot of tanks, a field manual on tank warfare will work. For counterinsurgency to work, you've got to have a host government that basically has the same goals that you do. You're trying to make that government more legitimate in the eyes of its own people so that the support for the insurgency will dry up. If they have a different notion of what legitimacy is than you do, it's not going to work. If you're on a bordering country where insurgents can just lie low in a sanctuary, it's not going to work. And the ironic thing is Petraeus, there was a book written by a French colonel named David Galula in the early 60s called Counterinsurgency Warfare. So it's like the Bible. And Petraeus would draw on this and reread it in particular lots of times. And there was one chapter called Conditions That Are Favorable for an Insurgency. And it lists all of these things, corrupt leader, sanctuary on the border. It even drew a map of what the ideal terrain for an insurgency was. It was a dead ringer for the map of Afghanistan. He should have known that this just wasn't going to work. But he thought, look, this is what I do. I mean, he was actually very – he wasn't quite as sanguine about it. He wasn't – he knew Iraq. He'd been there three times. He didn't know Afghanistan, but he thought that, well, the recipe worked here. Maybe it'll work there too.
But there are critics of the president who say that other political concerns or values helped to tie the hands of Petraeus in Afghanistan. And I think we have a caller on that point. Phil in Queens, you're on the air. Hello, Phil.
Happy New Year.
You too.
So I'm listening to the author, and I really don't agree. I think the surge worked in Iraq, and I think had we not pulled out, had we kept 20, 30,000 troops to continue some backup for the Iraqis, we would have been.
So you are talking about Iraq.
Iraq. Well, I can deal with this question.
Go ahead, Phil.
In Afghanistan, the rules of engagement, Obama put in a surge that was smaller than what the generals, the professionals wanted, and then he immediately undercut it by saying, giving a date when we were going to withdraw, and then he imposed rules of engagement in Afghanistan that have killed many of our boys and girls and had many of them wounded because we're not allowed to fire when they need to fire. In Vietnam, if you received fire from a location, we would light that location up. In Afghanistan, if we don't see the gun, we don't see the person, we're not allowed to fire on them. Obama has sabotaged Afghanistan, and it wasn't Petraeus. I mean, there are always political machinations within the general staff and vis-a-vis the civilian leadership, but Petraeus is one of the best, and this is a hatchet job.
Well, let me deal with a couple of things. First, in Iraq. We pulled out of Iraq because the Iraqis wanted us to pull out. There was an agreement, status of force agreement, signed by President Bush and Maliki, saying that by such and such a date, all U.S. troops will be out of all of Iraq.
And Bush wanted to keep a small force there.
He did.
And Maliki wouldn't let us.
He wouldn't let us. And I've talked with negotiators who worked for Obama to try to get a small force to stick around. These included Republicans left over from the Bush administration and Democrats. There was just an insistence. Now, as for Afghanistan, the rules of engagement, Obama had nothing to do with the rules of engagement. The rules of engagement you're talking about were set by Stanley McChrystal, who curiously doesn't talk very much about this in his new book.
General McChrystal, who's going to be on the show, by the way, in a couple of weeks.
Well, you might want to ask him about this, because he doesn't talk about it much in his book. He set these very restrictive rules of engagement, which, by the way, still allowed for firing back in self-defense. That's not true. That's a hoary myth. When Petraeus came into the command, he loosened up the rules of engagement. Now, it is true that there were no free fire zones. And there's a reason for that. The fundamental goal, and this was something declared by Bush, Obama, Petraeus, McChrystal, all these guys, the real thing was to protect the Afghan people. If you're doing that, sometimes you don't just go off and kill everybody because you're going to kill innocent civilians. And as McChrystal and Petraeus said, you know, if you kill 50 insurgents, but you also kill 10 civilians in the process, all of their cousins and wives or husbands become insurgents, right? You're creating 100 new insurgents, and you never get anywhere.
Fred Kaplan from Slate with his new book, The Insurgents, David Petraeus and the Plot to Change the American Way of War. By the way, Fred will be reading from and talking about the book at the Upper West Side Barnes & Noble, Broadway and 82nd Street, next Tuesday, January 15th at 7 p.m., Barnes & Noble, Upper West Side, next Tuesday at 7, if you want to see Fred Kaplan in person. And what does this have to do with Chuck Hagel, John Kerry, John Brennan, and these controversial nominations? We'll come back in a minute and talk about that. Stay tuned. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Fred Kaplan, who writes the War Stories column for Slate. He has a new book, The Insurgents, David Petraeus and the Plot to Change the American Way of War. So Chuck Hagel, President Obama's defense secretary nominee, part of the knock on him from Republicans like Lindsey Graham is that he opposed the Iraq War troop surge and said it wouldn't work. Petraeus is their hero. Are he and Petraeus adversaries?
No, not at all. Petraeus was director of CIA while Hagel was chairman of the president's Foreign Advisory Intelligence Board. I'm told by a number of people in the intelligence community that Hagel was very widely respected. He had no ideological axes to grind in hearing intelligence information about all kinds of things, including Iran's progress toward a nuclear weapon. No, this is trumped up stuff, really. It's trumped up.
So you don't think David Petraeus is seething and predicting that Chuck Hagel, small military advocate, will undo the Petraeus revolution?
The Petraeus revolution was kind of undone by Afghanistan, and I can tell you for a fact that he is not seething.
But as a critic of the surge, Petraeus didn't feel that Hagel was an adversary at the time?
At the time. But here's the thing. Even the supporters of the surge gave it maybe a 50% chance of working, even on its own terms, and acknowledged that in order for it to work at all, the American military people had to go live in the cities day by day. Casualties would go up quite dramatically at the beginning, which they did. It was a risk. Some people didn't want to take that risk. If you want to indict Hagel, you should indict the entire Joint Chiefs of Staff at the time, which also opposed the surge.
John Brennan nominated to succeed Petraeus as CIA director. And I think the essential mission of the CIA seems to be on the table. The Times had a good article about this yesterday. How much to gather intelligence, mm-hmm. steal enemy secrets, as the CIA's traditional mission had once been, versus being the, you know, black ops, zero dark 30 branch of the military. Yeah. How did Petraeus navigate those waters as CIA director?
Well, you know, he wasn't there long enough to put his own imprint on it. I do know, as with all CIA directors, there's a command post in the basement of their houses. I mean, they can go down at 2:30 in the morning any day of the week and watch the drone footage come in and direct things. But, you know, I think this either-or thing is a little bit of a canard. The CIA has always had an intelligence branch and an operations branch. They have always engaged in certain kinds of paramilitary activity.
They talked about the CIA being involved in the assassination of Allende in Chile in the 1970s.
They absolutely were. That's what I'm saying. This idea that, oh, well, the CIA, you know, classically is this very clean hands bunch of just very scholarly academics who analyze footage of Soviet missile launchers. Well, yeah, that's part of it, but it's also this other part. And it's at the service of the president. I mean, if you don't like what is going on with some of these things, and there's a reason for not liking it, it's not Brennan, it's the president. And that could be Bush, Obama, or whatever.
Petraeus is known as a counterinsurgency guy. Brennan is called a counterterrorism guy. Are those opposites in any way?
They can be, but counterinsurgency does involve a certain amount of counterterrorism. And Brennan has said that he understands that you have to deal with the social and political and economic sides of insurgency. So my problem here, here's the thing that I think really needs to be discussed about drone warfare and that sort of thing. It makes war a little too easy and a little too tempting. You know, there's a big problem someplace. It's very complicated. We don't have very many resources to do it, not much time to think about it. So here's this guy that we know is a bad guy. Let's just kill him. It'll take like 2 hours, maybe even 20 minutes if things are in the right place. It's a very tempting way to use force. It is very precise. But, you know, sometimes you can precisely hit the wrong target. Like, for example, during in the Bosnia War when we bombed the Chinese embassy.
Yeah,
this happens.
On the other hand, if it's that precise, even if some innocent civilians are getting killed, there's going to be a lot fewer civilians getting killed than in a traditional big war.
That's right. And so armed with that knowledge, maybe you do it more often, thinking that, you know, it's true. If you wanted to, like, fly an airplane over and drop a bomb, man, you couldn't get by without killing dozens, maybe hundreds of people. But if you can get a pinpoint thing, then you kind of delude yourself into thinking that war can be a kind of antiseptic, very pinpoint, precise enterprise. You lose sight of the murk and muck and hell on the ground below.
Did Brennan and Petraeus have much of a working relationship?
Oh, sure.
Brennan,
I mean, Brennan
doesn't appear in your book.
Well, my book doesn't really go in much to Petraeus as CIA director, but he was CIA director. Brennan is director of the Counterterrorism Center. Sure, they had a working relationship almost on a daily basis.
Why does Brennan seem to be too much of a dove for conservatives and too much of a paramilitary cowboy to the liberals?
Well, the paramilitary cowboy is this kind of suspicion about drone warfare, you know, robot warfare. And that's as for the why he's too dovish. Look, I think all the protest against Cagle and Brennan is really a disguised protest against Obama. I mean, one thing that is true about this administration, it is very much a top-down operation, and it's becoming more and more of one. I mean, you know, Brennan is coming out of the White House. Jack Lew, if he becomes Treasury Secretary, he is the White House's guy. In the meantime, Obama just won this overwhelming victory, his reelection, so you can't go after him, at least right now. So you go after his surrogates, you go after his proxies, you go after these guys.
Bob in Mountainside, you're on WNYC with Fred Kaplan. Hello.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call. You know, I was actually for the war and a neocon. I've recently changed. I'm more of a Ron Paul supporter, but I have to give Chuck Hagel his kudos. Oh, and by the way, that missile that went into the Chinese thing was not a drone. It was
a cruise
missile.
I was just talking about how intelligence, you know, the target was hit, but it was the wrong target.
And a lot of people think it wasn't an accident, but that's another story.
Well, yeah, it was. I mean, you know.
Anyway.
Bob, go ahead.
I was going to say that I think, you know, I mean, Hagel was right, I would say, and we were fighting al-Qaeda. I believe right now I'm reading that Iran is using Iraq's airspace to rearm Syria. So that was a total waste of blood and treasure, just like in Afghanistan right now. The neocons are the ones that are the last vestige of the Republican Party. You know, they destroyed Ron Paul. I mean, he's another one. They used that Israel thing to beat people over the head. If anybody, and even people in Israel don't even really general public I'm reading doesn't really care that much about it or think it's that big of a deal.
Well, maybe not about Hagel. I mean, in general, it's easier to debate Israeli policy in Israel than it is in the United States.
I read someplace that if somebody on the Senate stood up and read a speech that some Labor Party guy had read in the Knesset, he'd be denounced as an
anti-Semite. Yeah. John Kerry, Secretary of State nominee, does appear in your book, mm-hmm. and as something of a diplomat, as a potential Secretary of State should be. Tell us the story of Obama dispatching Kerry to Afghanistan to convince Karzai to abide by his own election laws.
Well, this is why I'm impressed with Kerry. You might remember early on as the one personnel bone that President Obama threw Hillary Clinton, he appointed Richard Holbrook as the Afghan-Pakistan envoy. His first trip, he starts yelling at Karzai the same way that he'd yelled at Serbs in Bosnia. It doesn't work. Karzai says, I don't want to see this guy ever again. And that's sort of it. So he needed to send somebody. So several times he sent John Kerry, who was chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And especially during this one crisis when Karzai, remember, that was like a stolen election. One third of the ballots were fraudulent.
Yeah.
And there was pressure to have a second round. And Karzai said, no, no way. And these inspectors are imperialists and I'm not going to do it. So he sent Kerry over, who was there for several days. As Kerry put it to me at the time, I drank 300 cups of tea.
Huh.
And at the same time, he was going back and forth between Afghanistan and Pakistan because there was a crisis going there, and Kerry solved it. Military people have told me that they watched Kerry in action, and they were impressed with his deftness, with his patience, with his knowledge of the issues. I mean, I think Kerry could be a really astounding Secretary of State.
A good sign for diplomacy, I guess, if Kerry has enough patience to drink 300 cups of tea with Karzai to get a policy change. Just one thing from today's news, a war story from today's New York Times that suspects Iran of staging multiple cyber attacks to slow down the work of American banks, not directed against the U.S. military or other government agencies, but banks. If that charge is true, how does a Defense Secretary Hagel or a CIA Director Brennan respond to that? It's not a boots-on-the-ground kind of warfare
question.
Well,
you know, this is, you know, for several years now, it started under Bush, and very effectively, we've been doing sanctions against their banks and against all banks that do business with Iranian banks. I mean, there is an incredible crisis there of currency and access to hard currency from abroad. So I think this is the Iranians' probably rather feeble way of striking back on that front. And you know, it is illustration of the point that Petraeus and many other people made, that this kind of war is a war on all fronts, political, diplomatic, economic, military. So they're trying to strike back in a weapon of war that we've actually been waging against them for some time.
The Stuxnet virus
Stuxnet,
kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, Stuxnet, yeah, that's pretty direct. That's a way to circumvent their nuclear program without bombing the nuclear program. Just sabotage it.
Fred Kaplan from Slate. His book is called The Insurgents, David Petraeus and the Plot to Change the American Way of War. Fred Kaplan will be reading from and talking about the book at the Upper West Side Barnes & Noble, Broadway and 82nd Street, next Tuesday, January 15th at 7 p.m. Barnes & Noble, Upper West Side, next Tuesday at 7. Fred, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
We're going to check in now on the latest regarding that ferry crash in Manhattan this morning. WNYC's Richard Hake is here. Richard, what's the latest?
Well, Brian, city officials just held a press conference from the scene of that. This is Pier 11, just south of the South Street Seaport. The Transportation Commissioner of New York City, Jeanette Sedeq Khan, said there have been 57 people injured, two of them critical, nine serious. Also, the vessel, which was a Sea Streak Wall Street catamaran traveling from Highlands, New Jersey to Manhattan, was going about 10 to 12 knots when it hit the pier. It actually hit one of the pilings and then knocked into the other one, going quite a clip.
Is that speeding for a ferry?
That seems like it was speeding because it was trying to dock at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
We did hear from a lot of witnesses who said, you know, of course, when the ferry moves in, they're waiting in the stairwells, they get up from the seats, and, you know, as it hit, a lot of the people fell down the steps. A couple windows broken from actually bodies or people getting, you know, tossed around in that ferry.
Any indication of how? Was it pilot error or?
I think it's too early to say. Obviously, there will be a huge investigation. We do know that the owner of the ferry has been involved in 28 incidents. This, according to the Coast Guard. So it's kind of not clear how often what constitutes an incident. Is it a small little hit into one of these pilings? But in January of 2012, this specific boat did hit a cluster of fender piles at Sandy Hook Bay Marina. No one was hurt there. In August of 2009, the ferry suffered a 2 to 3 foot tear in the bow above the waterline when it was trying to dock at East 34th Street, and that was because the ship's controls became unresponsive. Again, nobody was hurt in that incident.
And I don't know if you have any information on this yet, but I'm just thinking back to Sandy, which left us without some of the hospital beds that we previously had in Lower Manhattan. Do they have the trauma centers and everything to treat as many of these 57 or so injured people who need treatment?
That's unclear right now, but we did see all morning long they had the patients all lined up with blankets on to protect them from the cold all along that pier. But, you know, Beekman Downtown Hospital, which is just a couple of blocks from that area, did reopen after Sandy.
WNYC's Richard Hake, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Brian.
And coming up next, attention taxpayers, attention investors, hold on to your wallets. We have Helene Olin, author of Pound Foolish, Exposing the Dark Side of the Personal Finance Industry. Stay with us.